Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
What in the world is happening on Wall Street?
Economic indicators.
Who knows where this is going to end up?
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
How are you doing there? It is David. It's that time of the week again. Funny old week. It looks as if we're going to be even in a tighter lockdown for what's happening. How are you, Ed?
Well, when I hear that, I mean, I don't know about you, Mac, but I'm struggling much more in this final lockdown.
Yeah, you were
well,
telling
not final
me.
Lockdown. Go on and on.
It's the final lockdown. Go on, you got to get it in. Yeah, I know. I think, John, lots and lots of people are. I think it's a combination of before Christmas, particularly with the vaccine, there was a real case, okay, this thing's over. Our rates in this country were low. Mm. There was a sense that we're getting out of this thing. I think January's always a whore of a month anyway.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
How's your dry January going?
It's very soggy, actually.
Likewise.
But you know what? I am, you know, as you say, and like everybody's really tired of the lockdown and stuff and COVID. I can't actually watch any stories on COVID, but particularly the vaccine. Do you know why? Because every time they talk about the vaccine, out popped a needle sticking into somebody's arm.
And you're again it.
I can't watch it. I just can't watch it.
Well, John, we did suggest that you could go to France and have a suppository, which is the French way. Picking up your bum, my man. You know what I mean?
No, I'm all on for that.
Won't be the first time. Anyway, it is great to have
Jesus
you on board.
Christ,
it's great to have you on board. Good news from the States, though.
Oh, isn't that great?
It is great, actually.
And what was funny as well is the day after the inauguration, while everyone was celebrating the inauguration and stuff, there was a kind of a calm, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was.
And it was kind of nice.
Yeah, as if a kind of a nasty presence has left the building.
Yeah. We've been exercised.
Well, I mean, I don't know what you're going to be doing, though, because, you know, the last 4 years were food and drink to you.
Well, it was, actually. But let's just top off the whole Trump thing.
We're at peak Trump now.
Yeah, we are Trump. And I'm not going to go on, but I do have to mention a couple of things.
Go.
One was, when we were talking to Tom Frank last week, he was saying that the O'Biden administration...
Yeah. The O'Biden, yeah, exactly. The Obama stroke Biden with a genuflection to Clinton in the 90s.
Yeah, exactly. That he wasn't going to roll back a lot of Trump stuff. But on day one, he signed 17 or something executive orders, rolling back the XL pipeline.
Do you know
and
why? Because he's listening to us.
I bet he is. I bet he is.
There's a little gremlin at the US embassy there in Paul's Bridge.
Hey, Joey, this one's going out for you, man.
Hey, Joey. Yeah, exactly. But no, you're right. But I mean, they are going for it. I mean, on the economic side, they're going to roll out a $2 trillion stimulus. That's 10% of American GDP. It's huge in 1 year.
It's enormous.
So they are going for it.
And they'll get slated for that by the Republicans.
But huge
deficit, the usual El Shaddai.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing about the Republicans, we know that when they are in opposition, they are fiscal conservatives. And when they are in power, they spend like drunken sailors. That's the rule. It's like the Tories in England. The Tories in England are exactly the same. And you could say it's like Fine Gael here.
Ooh, right, yeah.
Same idea. If you get an opposition, are all kind of tight arse and, oh, don't do that, don't do this. And then they get in and it's, here we go, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But it's, I mean, it's the way the centre-right position themselves, always.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is, you know, when we're in opposition, we're one thing. And when we're in power, we're completely different. But it is good. I mean, there's a nice feeling about the whole Biden era, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. And I think he's going to be up against it. You know, every move he does, he's going to be slated from the right because they've set themselves up that way now.
Yeah, but look, he's got a majority in the House. He's got a majority with Kamala as the swing vote in the Senate.
Mm.
He is the president. He's got the Fed behind them. He's got Wall Street behind him. There's a lot of things going for him, you know?
Yeah.
And what about Lady Gaga?
Oh, she
you know
was
my crush.
I know, you're a big man crush on her.
She's supposed to have a lady crush on her tongue, which would be quite hard for me to do, right?
But do you know who's brilliant at the inauguration? By the way, I didn't really watch the inauguration. I only watched to make sure that Trump was off the press.
He's actually gone, exactly.
Get him off the premises and away we go. Yeah. And I didn't really bother. But I did catch Garth Brooks and his voice. He put on a lot of COVID kilos, I know, but his voice was unbelievable, singing a cappella.
Garth Brooks. A name that cannot be mentioned in Ireland without thinking of Croke Park.
I know.
And the fact that he sold it out 5 times.
Yeah, I'd go to see him now. Okay, that's going too far.
Man, we're talking about the Clash last week.
I lost the run of myself. We exited
with Gangsters by the Specials, and you're talking about Garth Brooks. Get out of here. But speaking of COVID bags and things, I'm going to train this week. I'm going to deal with...
Well, you've been doing okay in the training.
I'm telling you, my body is a temple.
Yeah.
My body is a temple. But Neil, our trainer, our boxer...
A Rioja temple.
Exactly. It's a temple to second-rate red wine. Neil Bowman, the guy who trains you and I.
Oh, he's brilliant.
And we are.
He's brilliant.
Former boxer is offering... And I think we should do this. We should do it together, right?
Yeah.
But he's offering a package to anyone. And again, if in the lockdown, your head's a bit melted, your routine is gone, you feel a little bit all over the place, I can tell you that trying to do a little bit of exercise makes a massive, massive difference. I'm not talking about fucking John and I being Iron Men now. I don't think so. But just that idea of being slightly in control of your day. That's it. You're kind of in control of something.
Yeah.
And Neil Bowman, who trains John and I, he's a former boxer, great guy. He's offering the podcasters, because he was saying that a lot of people that he actually trains listen to the podcast.
Yes.
And I said, why don't we just do an offer? He's doing an online 15 classes in February for €50, which is really cheap.
Yeah.
It's a great deal. So it's neilbowman.ie. So particularly for you, David McWilliams podcast listener, it's going to be an online course. But check it out and we'll give him a shout out at the end. What else, man?
Okay, this is my last thing on Trump and then I'm never going to mention him again. I just want to mention about his pardons. He did most of his pardons at about 1 o'clock in the morning. And he pardoned...
I just have this image of him.
Kind
of,
I know. It's weird, isn't it?
Yeah, horrible. But so who did he pardon?
He pardoned essentially all his mates.
Yeah.
And they were all corrupt. So the message that came from that is that corruption is good, essentially. But let me tell you, the one guy that I was just shocked, I didn't know about before that he pardoned, was a guy called Shalom Vise. Now, he was a fraudster and a Ponzi scheme guy.
Grifter, like your man.
Yeah. And he was money laundering, insurance scams, the whole lot. He was convicted and sentenced to 835 years.
Wow.
And he pardoned. Isn't that amazing?
Look, it confirms what there's a lot of people felt that the whole Trump enterprise, the family enterprise, was kind of like a quasi-criminal gang.
Yeah.
Of fraudsters and spoofers and tax evaders and whatever.
But the one guy I kind of felt sorry for, maybe I shouldn't, but the guy was expecting a pardon. He had got into his suit. He organized a limo outside the prison and everything. Do you know who that was?
Who?
Joe Exotic. And he didn't get...
The tiger fella.
And he didn't get pardoned. He had to shuffle back to his cell.
Oh, I must
admit. The poor fella.
The poor fella. But I mean, but again, I come back to this idea of a sort of a quasi-criminal enterprise.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it is. Here's Cal. How are you, sunshine?
Do you have any money?
Oh. Remember I was talking to you, John, about the difference between being an issuer of money, the central bank, and a user of money, right? There is evidence.
You are the central bank.
The central bank that my kids think that down here in the basement there is a printing press.
Yeah.
So that's what I've just turned into. Any odds? The good thing about Joe Biden is climate change, John. This is something you're really interested
in. Yeah, absolutely.
The first thing he said is we are going to profoundly shift the way in which America deals with climate change. And because America is still the biggest country in the world, the most important, this will have a profound impact. And in a couple of minutes, we're going to talk to Kate Raworth.
Great.
Yep. Who is a fantastic economist and the
fascinating stuff
author of that great book, Donut Economics. But this is a big change. Let's talk about the environment, because this week we're going to talk about green economics, how it can be achieved, why it has to be achieved, and why the last few days with Biden has changed the background noise. It's as if the orchestra has changed.
Yeah.
John, about 4 years ago at Kilkenomics, so when we're putting together Kilkenomics, what you do is you try to figure out what books are in the market, new ideas, and then try and find these people and say, do you want to come over to Kilkenny in Ireland for a weird festival? And an amazing amount of people say yes. And about 4 years ago, on our radar screen came this book, Donut Economics. Even the title, I thought, what is this? By a fantastic economist called Kate Raworth from the UK. And initially we were worried about, when you're putting these gigs on, you're always like, will we get a good enough crowd, Because the last thing you want is a big hall and nobody comes because nobody's heard of the thing. So there's a couple of great venues in Kilkenomics. One's called The Hole in the Wall, which is a 16th century. It's a 16th century building. It's an extraordinary place.
It's down that little laneway, isn't it?
Yeah, and it was crucial down the laneway. It played a crucial role in the Ormond Rebellion. Oh. In Cromwellian times, it was the Hole in the Wall because it was a secret chapel, in that place. So it's fantastic history, right?
That's great.
And run by an amazing character called Michael.
Yeah,
Michael happens to be. I remember one time, and this is one of the charms of Kilkenomics. I was sitting with Jeff Sachs, having a glass of wine, and Michael started talking to him. And Jeff Sachs, of course, knows everything about everything.
Yeah,
so talking about medicine. Right, yeah. And new medicine. And Michael revealed that he is the local heart consultant in Kilkenny, as well as the runner of the Hole in the Wall. And Jeff Sachs says, Anna here. I said, he is. He's the local consultant, cardiac consultant in Kilkenny General, and the man who runs the bar in the Hole in the Wall.
That's mad.
Isn't that mad? Anyway, we put on Kate Raworth. We said, would you like to come over? We really like this idea. She was amazing. And ever since then, this book has been, we put it in the Hole in the Wall, and then we could have sold hundreds of tickets to it.
Yeah.
And then bigger venues. And of course, this book has really changed the way people think about the economy. And Michael D. Higgins, our own president, has come out as being a massive fan of Donut Economics and Kate Raworth. So let's go and talk to her. Kate, it's lovely to have you. How are you?
It's fantastic to be here. It's great to hear you tell that story about Kilkenomics. That basically shows that if you want to get something in front of the president, just stick it in a pub in Kilkenomics and in a couple of years, he'll be talking about it.
Exactly. So simple. No, but I mean, Donut Economics, the success of Donut Economics has been phenomenal. And so much so that there's now an Irish Donut Economics Network, which we're going to talk about at the end. We're going to give them a plug and we're going to make sure that everybody tunes into that. If it's online, I presume it is online, and everybody maybe goes to that website or goes to wherever those guys are talking about Donut Economics. But Kate, tell me, what is Donut Economics?
So it sounds a bit crazy, doesn't it? So Donut Economics is the only donut that actually turns out to be good for us. Let's start here. We're not encouraging people to, an unhealthy diet. No, no, no. This is a conceptual one. You don't have to eat it. You just have to think about it. So let me start with the fact that we know we're in crisis. We know that we are living in times of, the 21st century began with financial meltdown. We live in an era of climate and breakdown. We are across the world living through COVID lockdown. These crises are occurring again and again, and they're emerging from the systems we've created. They're emerging from actually the economic systems that we've created that are based upon endless expansion, whether it's of financial assets or of the use of fossil fuels or indeed endless travel and expansion into wildlife areas. So we need to transform what we think prosperity and thriving is. And the donut is a vision of 21st century thriving. So just imagine in your head a donut, the kind that's got a hole in the middle. And the aim here is to leave nobody falling short in the hole in that middle of the donut. That's where people are falling short on the essentials of life. It's where people don't have food and water and healthcare, education, housing, all of the essentials that the world's governments have agreed that every person in the world has a claim to. So leave no one in the hole. But at the same time, don't overshoot the outer crust of the donut, because there we put so much pressure on using Earth's resources that we begin to break down the planet's life supporting systems. We break down the stable climate. We acidify the oceans. We create a hole in the ozone layer. These are known as planetary boundaries. So the two sides of the donut are like the boundaries for human thriving. Leave no one facing deprivation, but don't cause ecological degradation. So we need to thrive. And I'll just say that it changes the shape of progress. Because if you think about the way politicians or business leaders or even journalists talk about economic progress in the 20th century, and still now it's got a long tail, it's growth. Everything is about growth. Absolutely. GDP growth. Growth and recovery, the shoots of recovery, growth, growth, growth. And that, so the shape of progress in the 20th century mindset is this ever rising line that goes up, 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 up. It just goes through the roof off to we don't know where. It just grows forever. Well, nothing in nature grows forever. Things that try to grow forever destroy themselves and the system on which they depend. So donut economics starts from a very different place. It says, you know what? Things that thrive, that last, they grow until they're grown up and then they mature and they thrive. Just like our bodies thrive, right? Thrive in a range of temperatures. We need some food, but not too much. Some exercise, not too much. Warmth, but not too much. Just like that, from the human body to the planetary body, we need to understand that our well-being lies in thriving in balance. So instead of pursuing endless growth, we're pursuing a balance. And it's a really, really different, deep metaphor of what economic success looks like. So that's at the heart of donut economics.
And tell me, I want to have a look. I'm going to talk about donut economics in a sec, but you and me, both economists, both went through the traditional way of looking at it. When did you have, just personally, this epiphany? You said, hold on a second, this doesn't add up. Something else needs to be added to the mix, taken out from the mix. What was it that you said, okay, I don't believe the stuff I've learned anymore?
So, like you said, I live in Oxford, and that's because I moved back here to work for Oxfam nearly 20 years ago. But it's ironic because I now live in the city where I studied economics. I came to Oxford University in the early 1990s, a kind of bright-eyed student. I wanted to learn the language of public policy. Teenager of the 80s, I saw the Ethiopian famine. I saw the hole in the ozone layer. I want the tools and the skills to help do something about that. So here I came skipping to Oxford University to learn economics. And the bookshop that I went into and bought my textbooks, you know, is now my local bookshop. And the books, I was so busy learning economic theory because I'd never studied it at school. So I was on that kind of catch up with everybody else that at first I didn't notice. It took me about a year and a half to realize the stuff I cared about wasn't really visible. It was at the margins of the theory. If you wanted to talk about climate change and the death of the living world, economists will say, yes, 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 that's an externality. You just have to say, excuse me, even the word.
Is
the very word, the death of the living world, is what we call an environmental externality. Well, it's only an externality because economics goes, welcome to economics, here's supply and demand, and sticks the market smack in front of our faces on day one, as if that was the center point of the economy. And therefore, anything that falls outside market contracts, anything that doesn't have a market price on it, by definition, gets called an externality. Well, that's just a choice of how you've chosen to frame it, where you've chosen to start and what you've put at the center of your vision. And you've left the living world on the outside. So I really wanted to study environmental issues. There wasn't even a paper on offer at the university at the time to study environmental economics. I just find it phenomenal. So I'm just about to turn 50. So any policymaker out there in the world who's just about to turn 50 probably didn't really study environmental economics. And yet they are the ones who are now trying to manage the environment as government ministers. It's missing from the background, and it's still far too much missing today. Today, it's still an option. You can study environmental economics if you want to, but you don't have to. You could still graduate as an economist and know kind of diddly squat about how the living world actually works. And I'm sorry, but at the beginning of the 21st century, that is extraordinarily dangerous and wrong. So I was thrown by this concept of externalities, and I found myself graduating, realizing I never wanted to sort of put my hand out and say, hello, I'm an economist. Like, that just felt...
Don't worry. I've had that. We have many disguises. I've had that problem for many, many years. You can, you know, it's true. You know, a petty criminal is a far better introduction. You're far more interesting. You've got a good backstory. You have interesting mates. No, I hear you. I do hear you. So go on.
Yeah.
Keep talking.
And actually, when I was writing Donut Economics, I had very young children, twins who were about 5 years old, and I would stand at the school gates in the afternoon to pick them up and chat to other parents. And when parents would say to me, so what do you do? And I said, well, actually, I'm writing a book about rethinking economics. I mean, the first thing people do is they recoil.
Oh, yeah.
And then they say, oh, I was never very good at maths at school. And I said, well, look, the only numbers in my book are the page numbers. I mean, you can do this. Because yeah. I don't think economics is about numbers. Economics.
This is a hallelujah moment for me. Because, no, I swear to God, Kate, I mean, the reason I set up Kilkenomics years ago was to basically say, economics is not about numbers and maths yeah. and charts
yeah.
and things that repel people, because these yes. freak people out. I know, yes. I can see kids are freaked out. And I said, we put comedy in there to basically make sure that everyone speaks the language of the street or the pub or the bar and not this highfalutin language of the academy. And we'll see what happens. But let's come back to you. So you have this sort
of... Well, no,
moment.
that's very smart to do that. And let's start with economics, right? It's a word made up of two words from ancient Greek, oikos and nomos. It means the art of household management. So whenever I say to people, actually, economics means the art of household management. So let's just all start by thinking, what would you need to know if you really wanted to help manage the household? And in the 21st century, we can't stop short of anything but the planetary household. So the first thing you'd want to know is how this household works. So you'd start by learning earth system science. You'd understand that you need a climate system and a hydrological system, and that we need soils and a thriving web of life. And then you'd ask yourself, who are the inhabitants of the household and whose interests we want to manage? It's like, what are people actually like? Because mainstream economics has traditionally taught a very, very narrow model that's known as rational economic man. And it's this yeah. character. I drew a little picture of him. He's a little stick man, standing alone with money in his hand, ego in his heart, a calculator in his head, and nature at his feet. He's just a little calculating machine that wants to know the price of everything. And that's an absurd depiction of us. But when we tell ourselves that he's like us, researchers have found, this is fascinating, researchers found the more that we tell ourselves, so that's rational economic man, and he kind of sums up who we are, we become more like him. So students yeah. actually start to value competitiveness, value self-interest over collaboration and altruism, which is equally who we actually are. We are deeply social, collaborative creatures. Of course, we can be both, and we need to nurture the side of our human nature that will enable us to get along, 10 billion of us on this shared planet. So economics has to mean the art of household management, the planetary household in the interests of humans and the rest of nature. And then once we've started with that, and that's the donut diagram. Now let's ask ourselves, what kind of arrangements and designs? How could we use markets? What's the role of the state? Let's remember the role of the household, of unpaid caring work, the cooking, washing, cleaning, sweeping that goes on behind every door that makes life hold together and makes families, you know, it's the essence of care and love and nurture, and the commons. I mean, during the times of COVID, we've seen the commons step up, whether it's a community WhatsApp group, look, checking in on everybody, are you okay? Or it's a food bank. It's that sense of communal caring. And so we need the market and the state and the household and the commons. And for me, these are the essence of the economy, the interdependence of these actors. And so any economic class that begins with welcome to economics, here's the market, I just find an absolute violation of today's students who have to cope with the complexities of the world they've inherited. They deserve so much a richer starting point. So I wrote this book to bring together all the economics I'd never been taught. I dived into ecological economics and feminist economics, complexity economics and behavioral economics and institutional economics. And these are big sounding words, but they really yeah. bring very common sense ideas together. And I wanted to write it in a way that everybody can understand. You know, for me, my favorite thing is someone said, oh, I never thought I'd pick up an economics book, but I really understood this and I'm excited and I want to be involved. So I wanted to see what happens when these ideas dance on the same page. And it's a great thrill for me to find that the very bookshop where I bought my textbooks is now selling donut economics to this generation of students.
You know, when someone like Michael Dee, our president, reads this, what do you think sparks off in his head? What's the eureka moment someone like that is having? Because I also know that the city of Amsterdam is very interested in introducing your idea. So, I mean, this is gaining huge amounts of credence and huge amount of momentum.
Yeah. So when I was writing the book, I very intentionally thought to myself, I am not going to try and appeal to governments and politicians, because if I do that, I know I will write an incremental book. I will try and write something that's feasible and practicable and sensible. And I'll just write a book for 2020 economics. And there's a zillion papers and policies and recommendations already out there. Yeah. So I literally took out of my view government. The one thing that's really amazed me since the book came out 3 years ago is the number of governments and policymakers and politicians and civil servants who are kind of coming running to it. And I think it's a sign that they are ready for something transformative, but also how fast this world is moving, how fast these crises are multiplying, and how thin they know the language of growth is.
Absolutely.
Because they caveat it, we want green growth, clean growth, good growth, strong growth, resilient growth, shared growth, you know, have any future you want as long as it's growth. But actually, it's clear from that we want something more. So the donut as a concept is at the global scale of humanity on a living planet. But of course, most policymaking happens much close to home at the national level or the city level. And what's been really exciting over the last 18 months is the number of cities like Amsterdam, now Copenhagen. There's work going on in Brussels, in Berlin, in maybe in Barcelona, but also nations like Costa Rica. It's got a lot of resonance in New Zealand. And then I'm just thrilled that your prez, Michael Dee, has now picked it up and is saying he believes donut economics should be the compass. I have to say, David Attenborough, the man himself, has also recently published in his new book, his witness statement, he's published the donut and said, this should be the compass for the future. Wow. I know he's not government, but you know.
He's much more than government. He's much better than government. David Attenborough.
Well, he's incredibly valuable as an influencer because people listen to him and trust
Everyone listens to him.
So governments are listening to it because I can see that governments are, I do not envy any government right now, right? You're coping with a legacy of financial crisis in many countries and austerity that they imposed, for better or for much worse.
Yep.
You've got climate breakdown, which, thank goodness, there is the declaration of climate and ecological emergency in over 100 countries now. So brilliant activism has made governments recognize that we're in emergency. Now you've got to change, you've got to act, and you've got to get all those vested interests of fossil fuels and big chemical companies out of your pockets because you need to make a transformative leap in a new direction. But that's not easy. And now you've got COVID and health crises. So there's no way governments can try and respond to these one at a time. You know, you can't have separate.
No, absolutely.
Response. You've got to have a transformative mindset. And so I can see that governments are looking for something that brings them all together, and they all are visible in the donut. And then the questions are that what kind of investments are going to we make as we come out of COVID? What kind of investments are we going to make? Are we going to build back those old industries that have shut down? Are we going to go back and just reboot the old ones? Or are we going to actually leap towards the future we already knew we needed, investing in regenerative nature-based solutions that, like, the UK has phenomenally depleted landscapes, right? And I don't know the state of the land in Ireland, but here it's just such depleted nature. We have to reinvest in restoring nature.
I think if you talk to anyone who understands anything about what was here in Ireland and what is here now, just in terms of the diversity of the vegetation, in terms of the land use, etc., they will all say that we have depleted profoundly, but they will also say the beautiful thing about the planet is it's a renewable resource. It can do it. It can be reprogrammed. Now, what I want to talk to you about is cities, because there's a huge amount of discussion now, not just in Ireland, but everywhere, about what is the future of the city after COVID. So COVID's been the sort of wake-up call that, you know, do we have to commute in every day? Mm. Do we have to leave this house, which was empty, to go to that office and then come back, you know, et cetera? How do we create a living city? How do we create a sustainable city? How do we create a city that people put their hands up and say, I want to live there?
Yeah.
Tell me about that, because cities and progressive or forward-looking mayors, because sometimes progressive is sometimes an unusual term, forward-looking mayors and city managers have been flocking to you.
So cities like Amsterdam, it was really interesting, in the height of their COVID infection rate last April, Amsterdam released their Amsterdam City Donut, which is a portrait of the city we've created through the lens of the donut. So let me just offer you, and I invite anybody listening to think now of a city that you know and love. This is the ambitious question we invite every 21st century city to ask itself. Okay, so how can your city be a home to thriving people in a thriving place while respecting the well-being of all people and the health of the whole planet? So what does it mean for the people of your city to thrive, right? The culture, the norms, the values, the aspirations, it's going to be different in Dar es Salaam and Stockholm and Dublin. So the people of a place, their history, their values, their culture is going to determine what thriving means. What does it mean for your city to thrive in the ecological habitat that it's a part of? Every city is located on a different part of Earth's surface, in a different part of her web of life. What is nature doing there? How is she sequestering carbon and storing water and creating soil and housing biodiversity? And what would it mean for our cities to aim to actually be as generous as the wild land next door? You just said nature is incredibly generous. My gosh, she's been forgiving so far. How do we make our cities belong in the habitats of which they're a part? So that's local aspiration, thriving people in a thriving place. Then we have to ask, all the materials, the food, the electronics, the clothing, the construction materials that are imported into every city from worldwide, how do we bring the footprint of our ecological impact back within planetary boundaries? And that's a massive transformation. And how do we bring the footprint of the waste streams that we create back within? But also at the end of those supply chains are people who pick and pack our food and stitch and sew our clothes and dig and transport the materials. How do we respect the work of those people? So these are very, very big questions for cities. The 20th century city, and let's think of kind of capital cities with the big business district.
You know,
look at the buildings. You can see the mindset behind those buildings said, executives need to fly to meet face to face and workers need to commute to work shoulder to shoulder, right? And let's pack them high in these glass houses in the city centre. And what COVID has shown us all is that, you know what, we can have great conversations online, over Zoom.
Just like this,
Just like this one, we can get a lot done. And actually, I think there was a day in July 2019 where over 225,000 airplanes worldwide took off. Just think that, 225,000 airplanes took off in one day.
Wow.
July 2019 will probably go down in history, and I hope it goes down in history as the moment of peak takeoff, because we don't need all those flights. And though some of them are about family reunions and weddings and connecting with loved ones, a lot of them are about executives meeting face-to-face to make the next deal. We don't need that. So I think 21st century cities will move away from this intense commuting and traveling. And I think we're going to lean towards what Mayor Anne Hidalgo has been doing in Paris, which is called the 15-minute city. So she said, from any neighborhood within this city, you should, within 15 minutes on a bike or on public transport, be able to get to a place of work, your doctor, your school, your local shops, your community center. You should be able to live in a radius so that we don't have people traveling across all the time. And in fact, for many cities, it's like going back to the history. You know, I grew up in part of London. London, of course, is just a series of villages that ended up being interconnected. So it's coming back to that small village. Now, the beauty of that is it brings you back to community. We're all searching for community. People so often love where they live because they know the people in the coffee shop, their neighbours, they feel like they belong.
Absolutely. And there is this deep human yearning to belong to something.
Yeah.
And you know, when you go beyond family, it is community and it is clubs and it's volunteerism and it's all these things. We have this extraordinary organization in Ireland called the GAA, which is ostensibly a sports organization, but it's much, much bigger than that. And it goes deep, deep into, you know, initially it was a movement, a national movement 100 years ago, 120 years ago, but now it's deep in the community. And people really identify with it. It actually adds to their sense of the place, even if their engagement is only watching the sport or going down to the club. But it's the same idea. So let's talk about that idea that people want belonging.
Yeah. And I think I'm asking myself, why is it there's so much momentum at the scale of the city? And I think it is partly that people so often feel proud and they feel a membership and allegiance more to their city than their nation. Maybe that's not, you might understand me sitting here in the UK. I'm kind of feeling that at the moment. I find, you know, I would never go around waving a flag saying I'm English or I'm from the UK, but I feel much more proud of the place I'm from. And I know there's cities in the UK that people really feel proud they're from because that city's doing something. And of course, there's something about the scale of a city that it means you're often only three steps away from actually being able to be in a room with a policymaker, with a councillor, with a change maker, with that local business leader. So we can get stuff done at a city scale. And then also a lot of cities, of course, are about infrastructure. City governments don't have national policy levers. They can't control taxation. They can't generate new finance. And that's a real challenge for them. But what they can do is change a car lane into a bike lane. And then whoop, look how you flip the transport system. They can zone in, build in children's centres and see how you flock a new community sense there. You can make space for sports grounds and enable people to meet. So you can actually change the physical way that people travel and meet and connect. And that is so much the fabric of our lives. So I'm really excited about working with change makers at the city scale who've picked up the donut. We've created it as a what we call the Donut City Portrait through that question I asked, and we've published how we did it because we know that there are dynamic change makers everywhere who will pick up the methodology that we've made and say, right, we're going to put this into practice here, and we're going to tweak it because we're going to make it work for us here. And that's fabulous because then they're making it their own. And that's what's happening now. Change makers, whether they are based in universities or community groups or indeed working with the city council, starting to say, what would it mean for our city to meet the needs of all of its people within the means of the planet? Let's come up with our own vision.
Now, let's just maybe conclude in this. As you said, England is in a strange, neurotic place now with Brexit and with this present government. And the United Kingdom looks to be atrophying as a sovereign state, or at least it's going that way. There's a huge debate going on in the European Union. We have all these various different movements in Middle Europe and Eastern Europe. And we've got this quite significant difference of how you live your life between a citizen in Amsterdam, for example, and a citizen in Belgrade, and a citizen in Poland, which is going through its own very retrograde revolution now, it seems to me, and a citizen in Bordeaux. So when you look at all these crises and all these sort of slight little tremors going off all the time, are you confident that the enthusiasm for donut and donut economics, and it might not have end up being called this, but some sort of alternative view of the world, is more reasonable now in terms of being optimistic than it was 10 years ago?
So I like that you said that donut economics, and it might not end up being called this, because you tapped into something. Like, I've given it the most ridiculous name.
It's right? A great name.
No, like, come on, but it's crazy. It's so ridiculous.
Who doesn't like donuts?
I feel it's a bit like the comedy act that comes on before the main show. And I'm waiting for the main show to turn up with a really serious grown-up name. And so it's great that the comedy act is, you know, let's talk about donuts. But you know what? But partly because a lot of people are intimidated by economics, as we said, but no one is afraid of donuts. So when you stick donut and economics together, people know that this is for them.
Absolutely.
You have permission to play. You can take it and be silly with it. Let's have a laugh with it. Why not? So yes, there are tremors and setbacks, and every country is in its own turmoil. Now, a systems thinker who thinks in terms of complex system would at this point say, it's very interesting, you know, that complex systems, when they're at a tipping point, they have a lot of wobble in them. There's a lot of variation. They sort of tremor and wobble before they a system shift. Well, let's hope that these are tremors of a system shift. There's those who are leaping forwards and those who are absolutely clinging on to the old way and recalcitrant. So first of all, I'm going to hope that these tremors that we're seeing are system shifts. Secondly, this work of transforming our economies to make them fit for thriving 21st century, this is big teamwork. There are so many people involved in it, and there are so many crucial roles. So we need people on the team who are pulling down the old system, who are exposing corruption, who are, through transparency, revealing vested interests, who are locking on to oil rigs and stopping them from operating. I am so with those folks. But we also need people who are exemplifying the new, pointing out the possibility, showing the vision, and then pointing to where it's already in practice. And donut economics is standing there in this big team of transformers. It's standing in the space of possibility. So I'm also a mum of twins. They've just turned 12, which means over the past decade, I've had not very much time. I've been a mum. And so my strategy, it's forced me to have this quite simple strategy, which is just go where the energy is. I never knock on a shut door. I have never once asked or begged or requested anybody to ever talk about donut economics. And the beauty of that approach is that you then quickly find out where the energy is and who really wants to do this. So if there are countries and politicians and business leaders who won't touch it, or indeed economics departments, because there's plenty of them, who don't want anything to do with it, that's fine. You just carry on doing your thing. We are going to put all our energy in working with the change makers who don't wait for permission and don't wait to be invited, who just pick it up and start running with it because they know it's the future they want to create. So we're thrilled. We're working with teachers worldwide who say, oh, well, I'm just going to teach this, even though it's not on the curriculum. I'm just going to teach this because I know this is what my students fantastic. Need to know. No. I'm going to work with communities who say we've declared a climate emergency on a local council. Now we're going to create a donut for here. We're working with businesses who want to put into practice, with governments and policymakers. So we're going where the energy is. And we've created an online community. It's called Donut Economics Action Lab.
We're going to plug the Irish version
because it's true.
A friend of mine who's very much in this activist world once said to me, look, it's very simple. Go with the willing. Never go with the unwilling. The unwilling will destroy you. They'll sap their energy. They'll undermine you. They will destroy everything you've built. Tell me the Irish Donut Network. Tell me about, this is a cup of tea.
So first of all, for anybody, there's Donut Economics Action Lab, and you can just find it at donuteconomics.org. It's a platform anybody can join. There's tools there that we've made for teachers and community groups and businesses and governments. There's stories of how other people are putting it into practice. And the beautiful thing is we only launched about a month ago, and we opened the doors and all these people start joining and they think, what's going to happen? And of course, one of the first things that happened is some brilliant folks in Ireland said, right, we're going to hold a virtual cuppa. And they just advertised an event. Anybody in Ireland want to talk about donut economics? And they had literally the first event and a whole bunch of people turned up. And now they've set up a book group. They're reading a chapter a week. Anyone can jump in and join.
A nation of leaders.
You are right high in my heart at the moment, guys. From your president to your change makers to your book club. And they've formed the Irish Donut Economics Network, IDEN. It's even got a snappy acronym, you see.
Well, listen, we will be on this podcast promoting this. And Kate, we could chat all night. It's fantastic. You know, sometimes you get you know that idea that you just said about energy and the willing and going.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you read something and there's an energy jumping off the page. There's an energy when people, there's this idea when you meet people who are converting to something, there's a real case of this is possible. Yes. And all, as you said, all these tremors are just signaling that the old way is now, it's not redundant because nothing's redundant, but just take bits of that and join a new way. And you're right about the complex systems, you know, complex systems and complex organisms and living organisms. It's like our own body. How does our body deal with things? It deploys the immune system. We figure things out. We rest a wee bit and then we go forward. So, you know, Kate, it's wonderful. Are you going to come Kilconomics 2021?
Oh, I'd love to. Because we could have a great big old donut economics party in Ireland now. There's a darn community of you guys. And can I just say the last thing, that to me, the most fabulous thing about changemakers like the folks in Ireland who've started IDEN is they inspire others. So once there was an Irish virtual cuppa, one popped up in Brazil, one pops up all over the place. So the transformation, you know, your president saying, I believe in donut economics, we've posted that on our platform. And I've seen people email it and tweet it to their president saying, come on, next in line, come on. So you guys are leading from the community groups to the president. Thank you for this leadership. I swear it's going to inspire people everywhere. Join us.
Brilliant stuff. Listen, Kate, take care. This is fantastic. We'll talk to you soon.
Great pleasure. Cheers.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra.
and UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit UH1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
So, Kate there, John. I mean, I know you've done environment. You've got a degree in environmental science.
I just loved everything she said because, well, yes, I did environment. And there was a lot of environmental economics and politics that we did in the University of Greenwich. And that was the bit that fascinated me most. But at the time, they talked about externalities and, you know, as Kate did. But the problem was we all identified the problem, but there were no real practical ideas or solutions. And even to very, very recently, stuff like the environment and environmental economics always took second best to market economics.
Yes.
And it's this ongoing battle, as she referred to, it's a battle kind of within ourselves, either following market economics or the other side of it, which is a little bit more altruistic and caring and softer, you know.
Yeah.
And this is the ongoing battle. But now with donut economics, it feels like we're not quite there yet, but we're looking at practical solutions and a new direction.
And a new way of thinking.
This is what
I find what Kate is doing, and with some success, John, it must be said, is she's reframing, she and other economists, but she in particular, reframing the way in which we see economics. And rather than look at the living planet as something that we can gouge, abuse, and that will constantly forgive us. That's the idea.
I loved her phrase of the planetary household.
The planetary household. But these things are really critical. And I mean, the one problem, there's many problems with economics, but what I'm really enjoying at the moment is economics is actually going through a lot of self-analysis.
Yeah.
And there is a lot of alternative thinking, and there's a lot of people saying, hold on a second, this is not, this idea of linear growth without any damage psychologically, emotionally, environmentally, etc., is a nonsense. Yeah. It is a nonsense.
Well, you know the great quote from David Attenborough, if somebody tells you that there's endless growth, they're either a lunatic or an economist.
Exactly. But one interesting thing for Ireland is, think about energy in the future. Energy, renewable energy, has to come from one of four areas: wind, wave, solar, or geothermal.
Yeah.
They're the four renewables. Ireland is the Saudi Arabia of wind and wave. Go out the bloody door, you get blown away. If we can figure out a way of capturing energy, storing it in some sort of battery.
Yeah. It's consistency is the big thing.
But if we can figure that out, if engineers can figure that out, this place becomes the Saudi Arabia of the 21st century. I mean, the Danes already supply half their energy needs by wind.
Yeah.
So they've figured out, they've kind of clocked it. So there are huge upsides for us in what Kate is saying as a society, as a producer of energy. And we should look at it in this way. Like, this is not something to be afraid of.
Yeah.
This is something we can actually embrace.
Yeah. And I agree with you totally. But to put my cynical hat on,
you don't have a cynical hat.
I do. I have it in my drawer.
Good.
And here it is.
Pull that out. Exactly.
It's a little bit simplistic, a little bit utopian, a little bit woke, the whole thing. So in order to, I mean, I still like the ideas.
Are we a woke-free zone?
Kind of.
Yeah, okay, like fair enough. Yeah,
But how do we go about transitioning from market economics to this donut economics? How can we do that? How can we accelerate that?
Well, I mean, that's like, Andy Haldane was on this podcast a couple of months ago, right? And he said that real change happens when culture and technology change at the same time.
Yeah.
So when the technology allows the change, but also when the culture facilitates it. And I think that on the environmental movement, it is a matter of culture. It is a matter of reiterating all the time that, hold on a second, the idea that we can gouge the world of its resources, that in some way we can expand the planet. We can't. The planet is fixed, you know?
Yeah.
I'll give you a statistic. The average American consumes 32 times the energy of the average Kenyan, right? So think about this, right?
Wow.
So the population can only grow if our consumption goes down, maybe not to Kenyan levels, but to something like African levels. And that means a completely different worldview, right? And that's what you're saying. So cynically, the idea is that what always defines humanity is procrastination. I'll swat tomorrow.
Yeah.
I'll do my ecker after Glen Rowe
on
a Sunday night. That's, we're programmed. So you know when you were kids, you'd your ecker doing Friday night, Saturday night, never did it until the very end. This is the same thing, that economics facilitates procrastination. But if we can impose a cost through taxation on environmental degradation, then I think the conversation will move as it is moving. And the good thing about it is the more people like this that are in the ether, the more actual Joe Bidens that are at the at the top of politics talking about this, the better. And this can only lead to an economic system that is more sustainable. But I do take your point that for every Kate Raworth in economics, there are 100 tenured professors who believe in free market economics exclusively. Now, I always think that the market is critical because you can't run an economy without a market.
Yeah.
It still is the best mechanism, but it can be controlled and it can be nudged and it can be massaged and it can be influenced. And the best way to do that, unfortunately, still is through the price mechanism. And how you do that is through taxation. So subsidies for green energy and penalties for gas guzzlers. And I think it can be done.
Yeah, but just one thing though, Mac. You know, you just compared an American to a Kenyan.
Yeah.
But we also spoke about many times that in the coming decades, the one area that's going to develop at a much faster rate, especially with all the Belt and Road Initiative from China and all the investment, is Africa. So that balancing out, while we can reduce some of our consumption in the developed Western world, the consumption of resources is going to shoot up in the likes of Africa.
Well, I mean, you've painted, that is the big picture. So we're going to have 7 billion citizens, people. But if we say to those 7 billion people, you are 7 billion consumers, right? Mm. Okay, you're Chinese, you're Indians, you're Africans, okay, right? Then you will have this collision, whereas you've got the irresistible force of 7 billion consumers wanting to consume like Americans.
Yeah.
It's going to smash into this unmovable object, which is the limitations of the worth of the limitations of the planet's resources.
Yeah.
So that's the basic mathematics. So if we can find different ways of expanding energy, which are renewables, at least it'll begin the process of slowing that down. But I mean, you are right to be cynical. You are right to be skeptical.
Yeah.
But skepticism and cynicism is what actually leads us backwards, not forwards.
No, I know. And I'm also optimistic. I also feel that Kate Raworth and the IDEN that she spoke about.
Yes.
I think that is a brilliant first step and I'm right behind it all the way.
Just while I have you again, John and I are training with Neil. It's mainly for our heads more than our neds, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because the neds have got a mind.
Heads more than neds.
It is. The neds have got to mind their own. But anyway, neilbowman.ie, check it out. We're going to be training in February. He's offering for £50 online courses. We're all going to be stuck inside. And I'm telling you, it's good for the can, if nothing else.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.